John Hancock, Michael Kelly on News Radio 1120, KMOX.
Well, of course, it's not the Friday edition. It's the Monday edition, but that's the only intro we've got in the sport thing. So just to avoid confusion, it is Monday, Memorial Day, May the 27th, 2024. It does feel like a Friday, except rather than going into a weekend, we're concluding a long weekend. We're all back to work tomorrow, and some of us are back to work today. But I was driving around yesterday morning, and I had the voice of St. Louis on, and Scott Jago, gal, who does such a great job with the weekend at your service, or the weekend total information AM, I guess they call it. He puts a lot of work and a lot of effort into it, and he found just a fascinating piece about the origin of Memorial Day and how we didn't really know the origin of Memorial Day until the 1990s. And so we're going to replay that audio. This is Scott Jago talking about the origins of Memorial Day yesterday here on KMOX.
Now it's time for three good things.
One, two, three.
Tell me something good.
Oh, tell.
Do you know the origin of Memorial Day? There's a common story that it dates back to May 30th, 1868. A general of former Union soldiers proclaimed it Decoration Day, from the early tradition of decorating graves with flowers and wreaths and flags. But that was not the first Memorial Day. A couple years earlier, in 1866, there were remembrances of the Civil War dead in towns like Columbus, Georgia, and Carbondale, Illinois, not far from here. But again, that's not the origin of Memorial Day. The first observance happened on May 1st, 1865, in Charleston, South Carolina. There is written evidence to support this. Remarkably, it was discovered in a dusty box in the mid-90s at the Houghton Library at Harvard University. Here's how historian David W. Blight described what he found from a New York Herald Tribune article.
The story was just almost unbelievable when I first read it. About 10,000 people marched around the old planter's race course. But it said it was led by some 2,000 or 3,000 black children carrying armloads of roses and flowers and singing John Brown's body.
John Brown's body lies a-moldering in the grave. John Brown's body lies a-moldering in the grave. John Brown's body lies a-moldering in the grave. His soul goes marching on.
The children were joined by black men, black women, and Union troops. They marched around the race course and gathered in a makeshift cemetery that was created by local black workmen. It was the burial site for more than 250 Union soldiers who had been imprisoned.
And they heard preaching from five black ministers, according to this article, broke up and went back into the infield of the old racetrack and did what most of us do on Memorial Day. They had picnics, they had a speaker stand with speeches. The children ran around. And they had an archway, and over the archway they painted the inscription, Martyrs of the Race Course. These were the freed people of Charleston paying tribute to the Union dead. And it was their way of declaring the meaning of the war. That's the first Memorial Day.
The holiday was founded by African Americans. Today, a marker exists where the old race course used to be, denoting the first Memorial Day, May 1st, 1865. On May 3rd, 1915, Canadian John McCrae was inspired to write a poem while fighting in World War I in Belgium. Flanders Fields lives on as one of the most poignant war poems of all time, and it gave us the poppy as the new symbol of Memorial Day.
In Flanders Fields the poppies blow, between the crosses, row on row, that marks our place, and in the sky the larks, still bravely singing, fly, scarce heard amid the guns below. We are the dead. Short days ago we lived, felt dawn and sunset glow, loved and were loved, and now we lie in Flanders Fields.
Memorial Day is a time to remember those who sacrificed their lives or went missing in action. But let's not forget those left behind, the brothers and sisters, the parents and children, the friends and comrades. every day is Memorial Day for them. They have to live with the pain and the trauma and the memories. They're the ones who must soldier on in life.
Because we lost a lot of guys, lost a lot of friends. Lost my brother. And we live for ourselves, but we live for them. Because they didn't get a chance to. I want to pull myself out of my place, and I want to lift myself up and want to live. I don't want to live in this place anymore. I want to live.
And that's three good things.
The stars above in heaven now are looking kindly down. The stars above in heaven now are looking kindly down. The stars above.
It was a great little piece.
It was a great piece. I thought particularly worthy of replay this morning as we celebrate Memorial Day 2024.
Have you ever had the opportunity to go down to Jefferson Barracks and spend some time there?
Both of my parents are buried at Jefferson Barracks. Yeah.
It's a special place, right?
It is, yeah.
Yeah, I've always, when I was a Boy Scout, we used to go down there and put the flags up.
They did that yesterday.
Did they?
They had a ceremony, and then about 400 scouts went and put flags at every one of the grave markers.
Well, I hope they got them up before the rain came yesterday, because that was quite a storm. But Jefferson Barracks is always a special place to go visit, and so much that's happening, not only around Memorial Day and 4th of July and the holidays we have, but at any given time, that it's an active cemetery. People still being buried there now. You said your mom and dad were both there. Was that your father's wish to be buried there?
Not exactly. So, they had bought a grave site years ago, and dad passed away in 2010, and so my brother came to town, and we went out to go look at the site. And it was all overgrown, and the cemetery was not well kept.
Uh-huh.
And I thought, we all thought, you know, that's not what we want. And I think it was my sister remembered that dad had served in the Army, and I knew that, but had long forgotten it. He was in for a couple of years.
By volunteer or by draft?
I think he was probably drafted. Yeah. And so we called, and I mean, he qualified Private First Class Hancock. And so dad was buried, and he had the military funeral, like they do with the guns and, mm-hmm. and the folding of the flag. And so, yeah, he and mom are right there at Jefferson Barracks.
You said he hated the military.
So, yeah. So after the funeral, we went back to my mom's house and had the family over, you know. And my cousin had found a stack of letters at his mother's house, who was my father's older sister. And it was a bunch of letters that dad had written from the Army back home. And
hello, mother. Hello, father.
Yeah, so we opened these letters up, and the first one is, "Dear Mom and Dad and all, I hate the Army." And he said, I'm working KP again. And then the next letter, "Dear Mom and Dad and all, I sure wish I was home. I do not like the Army." So dad's not going to be too pleased on the resurrection day that he's out there with all of his Army buddies. But that's where his final resting place is.
Hey, John, at the end of the last hour, we spent a little bit of time talking about the presidential election and what seems like it's been going on for a decade here already. They're getting ready to have an election in Great Britain. They do it a bit differently. We're going to talk about it after this right here on the Mighty Mox. Many people complain about the elections we have here in the United States, that they go on forever. This presidential election feels like it never ended from the last one we had. But sure enough, we're just a little over a half a year away from the election, so it will be over pretty quickly. But nothing happens as quickly as Great Britain does their elections, John Hancock. They have a defined period of time. And their election's not a consistent date.
No.
And guess what the date is for this election? This coming election for the prime minister will happen on July 4th of 2024.
Yeah.
Over in Great Britain, they will be choosing potentially a new prime minister. The question is, will the Conservative Party continue to retain power after 14 years, or will the Labour Party, that had become so powerful under Tony Blair and lost it during that time in the midst of the conservative rule. We've had Brexit. more isolationist Great Britain has emerged. Yeah. They did away with being a part of the EU money system. They went back to the pound. Things haven't gone well over there. Well, there's an election on July 4th. Will the Conservatives hold it? Will the Laborers hold it? Will the Labor Party hold it?
Yeah, conventional wisdom right now, I think, indicates that Labor's going to win. They just had their local elections while we were there a couple, 3 weeks ago. And Labor picked up a massive number of seats in local government. That would tend to foreshadow that they're going to have a very successful result in July. Now, you know, it's interesting. They do their elections so much differently over there, not just the timeline, which is tight. But you actually don't vote for prime minister. You vote for the party in parliament. And so you go and you vote for your local
member of parliament.
Right. And they'll be, you know,
18 different parties.
Could be several parties. And you may have more than one representative that you get to vote for from your area. And so you vote for the party, and the party that wins, or the if there's a proportion, if there's a number of members of parliament selected, they are then, they take office based on the percentage of vote they got in that area. And then whichever party then controls parliament, they choose from among their members who the prime minister.
Yeah, they have to put together a coalition to get 50 plus one to elect the prime minister. So the prime minister doesn't even have to come from the body, much like the Speaker of the House in the United States, people may not remember.
Right. So Rishi Sunak is the current prime minister. There's been four conservative prime ministers just in the last couple, 3 years.
Over Brexit.
In Great Britain. It's been a very unstable period of time in their history.
Well, it was this same nationalism rise that we experienced at the same time. It coincided with Brexit leaving the EU.
Right.
And as a result, they've had inflation issues. They've had immigration issues. They've had so many issues over in Great Britain that the Conservatives have had a hard time agreeing with each other. Boy, sounds familiar.
Yeah, they have. And, you know, not a lot of economic growth taking place at the moment, and a lot of concern, a lot of striking. When we were there, the train workers went on strike, shut down the trains. And so that was a difficult time. The Labour Party, which is headed by Keir Starmer, is his name. He's the head of the Labour Party. He would become the prime minister, first one since Tony Blair from the Labour Party. Should they prevail, they have already said that they're going to take over the railway system. The railroads are private, and of course the rail system in Western Europe is critical, for getting around. And the Labour Party is going to take state control over the trains, and that's a promise they've made. There's been a lot of issues with transportation, just a lot of unstable situations, and that's why a lot of people think that Labour is going to prevail.
I think the thing that people find sexy about the British elections is that there's a finite amount of time that they can be advertising on television and radio for their candidates. I don't think Great Britain does anything better than we do. I think we're the best, and I think our elections are awesome. And obviously, you and I make a living doing elections.
Yeah, it'd be tough if they were only 3 months long.
I was going to say, but you can understand the attraction that people may have to have that process only be 3 months long. I don't know that it's better, but I can understand the lure of less time for everybody to sling mud.
Well, of course, in this country, we have the luxury. You can choose how much time you want to spend thinking about the election.
Right.
So a whole lot of people in this country aren't tuned into what's happening right now between Joe Biden and Donald Trump. I'm sure there's a fairly significant number of U.S. citizens that don't realize that the choice in November is going to be Donald Trump and Joe Biden.
Right.
Because they're just not paying attention, but they will. And usually, you know, here the bookend days, the Memorial Day, Labor Day, we're in that window of time now. And it's really Labor Day when most people start paying close attention to American politics. But yeah, they're going to have this election in July in England, and it could be now, you know, I don't spend time looking at the British elections like I do American elections, but right now Parliament is controlled by the Conservatives. They got 346 members to 205 for Labour.
Right.
So it will have to be a massive turnover.
Well, but I think there's a coalition government there that's been put together, because I think the conservative may be reflective of a couple of other parties that have been bundled in there. Am I right?
Well, but there are 346 conservative party members now. Yeah, and there's a handful of other parties that have, you know, smaller numbers.
You just were there. Obviously, if someone were to come to the United States, you could quickly pick up that immigration is a big issue, that crime and policing seems to be something that folks are focused on, whether they're in Oklahoma City or New York City, for that matter. Did you get any of that nationalism or that isolationism feel that?
Certainly on the immigration front, yeah. I didn't sense and didn't have any conversations that there's a much of a crime problem, even in London. So that didn't come up.
Inflation?
Inflation's an issue. Kids graduating from school without a job is an issue there. A couple of the cab drivers were sharing stories about their family members. But the immigration's big, and you know, Sunak, the current prime minister, has made this commitment that there's boats coming over from France full of folks from all over Africa, the Middle East, that they were going to start flying them back home and having their hearings for asylum heard back in their home countries before they could come to Great Britain.
Right.
And that's a commitment they've made, but they've not been able to implement it yet. So that's another thing that Labor's running on, that, you know, Labor's basic theme is we are going to make the trains run on time.
Right.
And it includes taking over the trains, but it's every aspect of government, which is not dissimilar from Kara Spencer's message here in the city of St. Louis.
Well, in the European Union, John, which I know Britain has separated from the EU, but it nearly mimics it, and they're reflective of a lot of those policies. They're dealing with immigration in the same way the United States is. There's this mass relocation of humans taking place.
Right.
Now, theirs is even compounded more by war that's going on right now, but they're seeing the influx of immigrants coming in and facing the same issues of jobs and payment and voting, etc.
Yeah. And you've seen a wave of nationalism. I mean, you look at Viktor Orban in Hungary, very strong nationalistic leader, elected leader. Emmanuel Macron was able to fend off a nationalist opponent in his last election. But that sentiment that exists over there is very much part of the sentiment that exists in this country to kind of take care of your own.
We got a champion going to join us in our next segment. Tell the people who's joining us and what he's a champion of.
So, as you may or may not be aware, I love snooker. It's a great game. And I got to go to the World Championships this year over in Sheffield, England. Phenomenal experience. It's a great game. We'll tell you a little bit about the game. I got to meet the former world number one and former world champion, Cliff Thorburn. He was the first non-British snooker player to win the world championship. He did that in 1980. He's from Canada, and he's going to join us next on this Memorial Day Monday on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX. Welcome back to KMOX. John Hancock alongside Michael Kelly. Happy Memorial Day to all of you that are out there. Those of you that are frequent listeners to Hancock and Kelly know that I have become very passionate about the sport of snooker. It's a billiard game played on a much larger table, and I compare it like this. If playing pool is like checkers, you're trying to make balls, whatever. Playing snooker is like chess, highly tactical, very thoughtful. It's just a fascinating game, and it's tricky to play and quite fun. And Georgianne got me and her tickets to the World Championship this last season over in Sheffield, England at the Crucible Theater. It's sort of the mecca of snooker, and we were honored to meet so many of the players, one of whom is our guest now. And think about this, folks. You may not know anything about snooker, but think about how rare it is to be one of the best in the entire world at anything, at something. That there's a handful of people in the entire planet that have the skill that you possess in whatever it may be. And joining us right now is one of the greatest snooker players to ever live. He was the world champion in 1980. He was the world number one in 1981 and 82, the best player in the world, the first champion snooker player from outside of Great Britain. He's a Canadian. And when he won at the Crucible Theater in 1980, it sounded like this.
Well, I don't think there's going to be another moment in Cliff's life when he's going to be so tense as this.
And there he did it. The last two balls of the frame. He became the world champion in 1980. I had the honor and pleasure of meeting him and getting to know him a little bit. And he joins us now in the voice of St. Louis, the great Cliff Thorburn. How are you, partner?
Yeah, fine, John. Great. Thank you very much. And nice to hear your voice. And I can, when I hear your voice, I can see your happy face. You were so, enamored with the game and everything that, boy, you really brought some joy to the room whenever you walked in. And I'm just not saying that either.
Well, thank you. That Crucible Theater is hard to explain to people. You've got 980-some seats in there, and there's not a bad seat in the house. Everybody in there is focused on what is a very intense match of two people. For you, you're coming up through the ranks in the 1970s. You're getting better and better. What was it like as a player to enter that atmosphere at the Crucible Theater?
Well, I played in the first one that was there in 1977. I was getting pretty close to about 30, I guess. But I still felt a bit like a Russian hockey player playing in North America. Well, he's good, but he's not one of us kind of thing. It wasn't really all that bad, but I could sort of feel that. And it sort of gave me an extra lift. But as far as being nervous and everything, I felt pretty good because I'd been, playing on television for quite a while. And once you get to the final stages of a tournament, basically I just used to get numb. And that was the greatest feeling that I had in snooker was, being at the end of a match and having pressure shots. It just, I almost lived for the 4-4 game, the best of nine, et cetera. I felt great. And when I potted the final ball, I thought about my father who actually didn't want me to play snooker. And I didn't think of it in that way, but that's how I got started. I just explained to him how wonderful that the game looked, and he said those four famous words, don't go down there. So I went, oh, yeah, why not? So, but that was a big part of it, and my dad pushed me into sports, so that's the first thing I thought of, and then, of course, the rest of my family, my wife as well.
Yeah, and you played lacrosse. You had a really kind of a rough upbringing. You've raised by your father and your grandparents, really. And I would have to imagine that snooker became almost like a companion for you.
Yeah, it did. I had a love of sports, of course, with the spin of balls, etc. And my dad being sports minded, that was where I felt the best anywhere, and that was just playing ball games. Yeah, lacrosse wasn't a future for me, but I wanted to play because it was a ball game. Any kind of sport I played, but once I started to play snooker and at first I was just chasing the object ball around, like the ball that you shoot with the cue ball. I was just chasing that around the table for a year or two, but then after a while I started to control it, and I never had a long time, every month or so I'd notice a big improvement in my game. So I just followed that, and I wanted to watch and play and talk to all of the top players. But of course, I was born in Victoria, BC, I ran out of players to play, and then I went to Vancouver, but I could see myself getting better, and I just knew for some reason I just followed my dream, and I met so many wonderful people along the way that helped me out, but I couldn't, I didn't want to go to bed, and I couldn't wait to wake up to play snooker, so I followed that for a long time. I still love the game medley, as you probably well know, after after we talked over in Sheffield.
Yeah, it's a fascinating game, and it's a tactical game. And your style of play, your nickname is the Grinder, and it's an apt nickname. The game has become, it's changed over the years. It's a lot more aggressive now. But the folks that played the kind of methodical, tactical game, for me, that's snooker. And that's really kind of your hallmark. You approach that table as a scientist almost, right?
Well, to be honest with you, playing safe was pretty darn easy for me. I mean, playing safe is a little bit, it's a little bit easier than potting the balls. But yeah, I had a mind for it. I you know, that playing safe is a pretty good B game. But what you want to do is you want to trap your opponent so that he'll leave you a shot. But then you have to be an attacking player because now you're in the balls. You don't want to be playing safe all day. And I became very good at break building and running points. I mean, I had a fellow walk by me one day, and he said, "Thorvin, you spend more time on the table than the cloth." You know, so I knew that I was doing something right there. But everybody else was playing backgammon or chess, and they're great games, of course. But I just loved to play, and if a shot was giving me problems, so then I would work on it. But there's an old adage that if it's more difficult to play safe than go for a pot, well then you go for the pot, and that's if you follow that rule, that will help your play, rather than getting all muddled up and everything. And it's it's more fun when you go for a pot, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, yeah, but you got to be able to execute the tactical aspect of the game. Now, so for folks that don't know, there's 21 balls on the table, 15 red balls, 6 colored balls. Reds are worth 1 point. The colors are worth 2 through 7, depending on the color. A black being worth 7. It's the highest valued color ball. A perfect game in snooker, it's called a maximum break. It's 147 points. That means you make 36 balls in a row on a 12-foot by 6-foot table with small pockets and rounded edges and not pointed corners, which means your balls have to be dead center perfect. John Hancock alongside Michael Kelly. Happy Memorial Day to all of you that are out there. Those of you that are frequent listeners to Hancock and Kelly know that I have become very passionate about the sport of snooker. It's a billiard game played on a much larger table, and I compare it like this. If playing pool is like checkers, you're trying to make balls, whatever. Playing snooker is like chess, highly tactical, very thoughtful. It's just a fascinating game, and it's tricky to play and quite fun. And Georgianne got me and her tickets to the World Championship this last season over in Sheffield, England at the Crucible Theater. It's sort of the mecca of snooker, and we were honored to meet so many of the players, one of whom is our guest now. And think about this, folks. You may not know anything about snooker, but think about how rare it is to be one of the best in the entire world at anything, at something. That there's a handful of people in the entire planet that have the skill that you possess in whatever it may be. And joining us right now is one of the greatest snooker players to ever live. He was the world champion in 1980. He was the world number one in 1981 and 82, the best player in the world, the first champion snooker player from outside of Great Britain. He's a Canadian. And when he won at the Crucible Theater in 1980, it sounded like this.
Well, I don't think there's going to be another moment in Cliff's life when he's going to be so tense as this.
And there he did it. The last two balls of the frame. He became the world champion in 1980. I had the honor and pleasure of meeting him and getting to know him a little bit. And he joins us now in the voice of St. Louis, the great Cliff Thorburn. How are you, partner?
Yeah, fine, John. Yeah, great. Thank you very much. And nice to hear your voice. And I can, when I hear your voice, I can see your happy face. You were so, you know, enamored with the game and everything that, boy, you really brought some joy to the room whenever you walked in. And I'm just not saying that either.
Well, thank you. That Crucible Theater is hard to explain to people. You've got 980 some seats in there, and there's not a bad seat in the house. Everybody in there is focused on what is a very intense match of two people. For you, you're coming up through the ranks in the 1970s. You're getting better and better. What was it like as a player to enter that atmosphere at the Crucible Theater?
Well, I played in the first one that was there in 1977. I was getting pretty close to about 30, I guess. But I still felt a bit like a Russian hockey player playing in North America. You know, just, well, he's good, but he's not one of us kind of thing. It wasn't really all that bad, but I could sort of feel that. And it sort of gave me an extra lift. But as far as being nervous and everything, I felt pretty good because I'd been, you know, playing on television for, you know, for quite a while. And once you get to the final stages of a tournament, I mean, basically, I just used to get numb, and that was the, you know, the greatest feeling that I that, you know, had in snooker was you know, being at the end of a match and having pressure shots. It just, I almost lived for the 4-4 game, you know, the best of nine, etc. I felt great, and when I potted the final ball, I thought about my father who actually didn't want me to play snooker, and I didn't think of it in that way, but you know, that's how I got started. No, I just explained to him how wonderful that the game looked, and he said those four famous words, don't go down there. So I went, oh, yeah, why not? So, you know, but that was a big part of it, and my dad pushed me into sports, so that's the first thing I thought of, and then, of course, the rest of my family, my wife as well.
Yeah, and you played lacrosse. You had a really kind of a rough upbringing. You've raised by your father and your grandparents, really. And I would have to imagine that snooker became almost like a companion for you.
Yeah, it did. I had a love of sports, of course, with you know, the spin of balls, etc. And my dad being sports minded, that was where I felt you know, the best anywhere. And that was you know, just playing ball games. Yeah, lacrosse wasn't a future for me, but I wanted to you know, play because it was a ball game. Any kind of sport I played, but once I started to play snooker and just you know, just well, I guess at first I was just chasing the object ball around, like the ball that you shoot with the cue ball. I was just, you know, chasing that around the table for a year or two, but then after a while I started to control it, and I never had a long time to, didn't like, every month or so I'd notice a big improvement in my game, so I just followed that, and you know, I wanted to watch and play and talk to all of the top players. But of course, where I was born in Victoria, BC, I ran out of players to play, and then I went to Vancouver, but I could see myself getting better, and I just knew, for some reason, I just followed my dream, and I met so many wonderful people along the way that helped me out. But I didn't want to go to bed, and I couldn't wait to wake up to play snooker. So and I followed that for a long time. I still love the game medley, as you probably well know after we talked over in Sheffield.
Yeah, it's a fascinating game, and it's a tactical game. And your style of play, your nickname is the Grinder, and it's an apt nickname. The game has become, it's changed over the years. It's a lot more aggressive now. But the folks that played the kind of methodical, tactical game, for me, that's snooker, and that's really kind of your hallmark. You approach that table as a scientist almost, right?
Well, to be honest with you, playing safe was pretty darn easy for me. I mean, playing safe is a little bit, it's a little bit easier than potting the balls. But yeah, I had a mind for it. You know, that playing safe is a pretty good B game, but what you want to do is you want to trap your opponent so that he'll leave you a shot, but then you have to be an attacking player because now you're in the balls. You don't want to be playing safe all day. And I became very good at break building and running points. I mean, I had a fellow walk by me one day and he said, "Thorvin, you spend more time on the table than the cloth." You know, so I knew that I was doing something right there, but everybody else is playing backgammon or chess, and they're great games, of course. But I just love to play, and if a shot was giving me problems, so then I would work on it. But there's an old adage that if it's more difficult to play safe than go for a pot, well then you go for the pot, and that's if you follow that rule, that will help your play, rather than getting all muddled up and everything. And it's more fun when you go for a pot, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, yeah, but you got to be able to execute the tactical aspect of the game. Now, so for folks that don't know, there's 21 balls on the table, 15 red balls, 6 colored balls. Reds are worth 1 point. The colors are worth 2 through 7, depending on the color. Black being worth 7. It's the highest valued color ball. A perfect game in snooker is called a maximum break. It's 147 points. That means you make 36 balls in a row on a 12-foot by 6-foot table with small pockets and rounded edges and not pointed corners, which means your balls have to be dead center perfect to go in. And to get a maximum break, you make 15 red balls followed by 15 colored balls that get then respotted, and then you run the last 6 colors in order. That's a total of 36 shots in a row. Very hard to do. Extremely hard to do. And the first perfect break at the World Championships at the Crucible Theater in Sheffield was completed by none other than Cliff Thorburn, a 147 break in 1983. What was that like?
Well, that was that's what people talk about over in the UK, whereas winning the championship was is more talked about here. But that was nobody had done it on the BBC telecast, and it had never been done before, of course, since the game of the first professional championship started in 1927. But I actually had a dream about 2 months before that I made a 147 in the world championships. I felt like I had done it before. And once I got towards the end, I was pretty calm, but I would, like when you hear golf stories, when somebody says, "Well, I bet you made that putt before, like to win the US Open," I must've shot that last shot 10,000 times, this for Cliff Thorburn to make the 147 break. And, I felt that calm at the end that, I just wanted the black ball to go straight into the pocket and not even touch the side. So I felt terrific. And then after there was a bit of, joyous celebration for, for about a minute. And then I went back backstage and some young lad asked me for my autograph and I couldn't even sign my name. My hand was flipping all over the place. And I thank God for not feeling like that when I shot the last ball. But anyways, yeah, it was a great moment for me. And the 36 balls is great. Black ball is situated down near the, the cushion on one of the ends. And of course it's the most difficult of all the balls that are on the colors to pot, and that's why it's worth 7 points. But yeah, a great moment for myself and something I'll never forget. So can I just say something here? Can I say
absolutely?
Yeah. well, this fellow who's a friend of mine over in the UK is his name was Richard Johnson, and he was involved with a book publishing company. But anyways, Richard bought the cue that I made the 147 on. So in his office in London, he's got a table set up. Ooh. So now, he's got my cue, like the 147 cue, is just sort of standing up against the wall, or in a place like to keep it safe, and that anybody that walks into the place, they can actually pick up that cue and then walk over to a spot on Richard's table where the cue ball was exactly, you know, where it was on my final black ball, and there's a little white spot there. So you can put the cue ball up and then have a go at the final, you know, the final
That's
black
and cool.
one with my 147 cue. You know, yeah, so I think that's really neat, you know, that people can actually do that. So
it's
it meant a lot to
game.
Somebody, that's for sure.
It's such a great game. And we're speaking with one of the greatest snooker players to ever live, Cliff Thorburn. And, sir, you're back in Canada now, enjoying what is going to be a nice summer, I hope.
Yes. Yep. I was up at the CN Tower having dinner about two nights ago, and with my wife and a few friends. And yes, it's good to be back home, although I'm from Victoria, BC, but just a little bit of golf now. But I'm Canada's national snooker coach. So, you know, I'm going to be busy soon. And one of my best pals just won the Canadian championship yesterday. So we're going to have a little celebration.
Well, we're still... Michael and I are still working on our game, and but probably could use a little coaching one of these days. But, hey, thanks so much for taking the time. I so enjoyed getting to know you and all of the other – it's just a great community, that snooker community. And Cliff Thorburn, kind enough to join us from Canada this morning on Memorial Day. Thanks so much, sir.
It's my pleasure, John, to be safe, and it was great to meet you. Look forward to next time.
All right, Michael, we need to step aside.
When we're back, it's Hancock and Kelly right after this on KMOX. So that was really fun to watch you geek out, dude.
Yeah, that was fun.
So interesting, when I hear British people talk about snooker, they call it snooker.
Snooker. Yeah.
Snooker.
Yeah.
And he called it snooker.
Snooker,
just like us.
Like us, yeah,
yeah.
He's Canadian.
Yeah, he seemed like a regular. The other description he had when he said that being a snooker player was a lot like being a Russian hockey player
in Canada,
in the United
yeah.
States.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was cool. And John, you made an impression on him. I mean, he remembered your face and your smile. I tease you a lot on this station, but you know, you're a jovial, chipper guy, and I can imagine you made an impression on a bunch of people over there. You were like a little unicorn, weren't you? There was no other Americans there.
There were no other Americans there. And, yeah, we met a couple of guys from Ireland, brothers. They were a lot of fun. Met a couple of buddies from Denmark, Gorm, and I can't remember Gorm's buddies. Gorm was his name.
What was the mean age at the Crucible?
Older.
Yeah, 50s, 60s?
Yeah, I mean, there's some young fans, to be sure.
Right.
The sport was at its heyday back in the 1980s. When Cliff was playing, it was so popular in England. And it's still quite popular, but it's not what it used to be. Football's taking everything over there, the soccer.
So when we play pool in St. Louis, the United States, we have those sticks that are two pieces. You
right.
screw them together.
Yep.
Do these folks play with one piece
Almost
or two piece?
Everybody plays with a one piece cue.
So it's just
and
one
cue. But
stick.
These guys, their cues are all custom built.
Uh-huh.
And there's John Paris is a guy that makes a lot of cues for the pros over there. They use a higher quality chalk. It's a great game. I could talk about it all day, but we're out of time.
He's John Hancock. I'm Michael Kelly. We're going to talk about some cueing after this on KMOX.